From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, settling accounts with torturers. Journalist Lawrence Weschler examines two fledgling democracies where torture victims and human rights activists try to get even with the torturers of the old regime. Also today, a talk with Oscar Iuelos, who just won a Pulitzer Prize for his novel The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a pair of newly reissued Ornette Coleman albums from the late 60s. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us if Spy magazine is as funny on TV as it is in print. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. There's no sign yet that key Soviet supplies are being cut off to Lithuania, even though the Kremlin's deadline passed yesterday with the Baltic Republic still refusing to drop some of its independence measures. Lithuanian leaders met today to discuss ways to replace oil, gas, and other supplies if they are cut off. The Baltic Republic's government also sent a message to Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev asking for clarification of his threat to stop sending supplies. A suspected major drug trafficker remains on the loose today after he escaped from a private prison in San Antonio last night. NPR's John Burnett reports.
A swarm of federal, state, and local lawmen are scouring the South Texas brush country for three fugitives believed to be headed for Mexico. One of them is 37-year-old Alberto Salinas Trevino, who's suspected of masterminding a smuggling ring that supplied marijuana and cocaine to five states. Last night, Salinas and two cellmates pulled out a small pistol, overpowered their guards, and escaped from their privately run medium security jail. The Central Texas Parole Violators Facility is located across the street from police headquarters. When Salinas was arrested by federal agents a year ago, he had $10 million on him, and he's believed to have stashed another $10 million in drug profits somewhere in Texas or Mexico. Five federal agencies and Mexican Customs are on the lookout for the fugitives, who are considered armed and dangerous. This is John Burnett reporting.
The Sandinista government accused the Contra rebels today of planning to launch an offensive the day before the April 25th transfer of power to President-elect Violeta Chamorro. The accusation came just hours before a delegation of U.S.-backed Contra leaders was scheduled to arrive in the capital for disarmament talks. About 2 hours before the Contra's arrival, a series of explosions was reported near the international airport. Officials say the explosions appear to have been accidental. No injuries were reported. A Cincinnati museum is one step closer to going to trial on obscenity charges. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU explains.
The Cincinnati Contemporary Arts Center and its director have been charged with misdemeanor obscenity charges in connection with an exhibition of photographs by the late Robert Mapplethorpe. Today, attorneys for the museum and its director, Dennis Barry, entered innocent pleas. A trial date may be set after the pretrial hearing in 2 weeks. Museum attorney Louis Serkin is demanding a jury trial, and he says he will not make a deal with prosecutors. The exhibition of 175 photographs includes five scenes of homosexual behavior and two with nude or semi-nude children. A grand jury indicted the museum earlier this month on charges of pandering obscenity and using children in nudity-oriented material. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today as the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 11 points to close at 2736.06. Declines led advances marginally in moderate trading. This is NPR. The American Academy of Pediatrics said today that children in the U.S. spend more time watching television than doing anything else except sleeping. A report by the group said because of that, children are becoming both fat and violent. The doctors made the comments in a policy statement published in the April issue of the American Academy of Pediatrics News. The statement said that in 1989, children spent about 25 hours a week watching television. Three companies involved in the production of fighter plane simulators for the Navy have been accused in a federal lawsuit of defrauding the government of $16 million on defense contracts. The charges were listed in legal documents made public today. A civil suit filed last week charges that Sperry Corporation, Unisys Corporation, and Honeywell Corporation inflated labor costs for manufacturing F-18 and T-45 fighter simulators, which are computer-driven devices used in training pilots. The suit seeks triple damages of $48 million. Today in Nepal, that country's king was forced into another political compromise, appointing as his prime minister the president of one of the recently legalized political parties. As the BBC's Mark Tully reports, the king feels this is a defeat for his policy of a gradual switch to multi-party democracy.
The king hoped that would give him time to consider his position and negotiate with the leaders of the democracy movement. But young supporters of that movement mounted pressure on their leaders, and they came back with a demand for an interim government. The king tried to stall that by promising a government, but only after further negotiations. Those negotiations collapsed within a day, and there were more demonstrations during which slogans were shouted against King Birendra. So he was forced to dismiss the Panchayat Prime Minister and appoint the Prime Minister from the Nepali Congress, which, with a seven-party left-wing alliance, has organized the movement for democracy.
The BBC's Mark Tully. Again on Wall Street, stock prices closing higher today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rising by 11 points. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Romanians are trying to build a democracy. One of the tough questions they face is what to do with the Securitate, Nicolae Ceaușescu's secret police, who spied on Romanians and tortured the regime's opponents. Will the secret police be executed, imprisoned, or reintegrated into society? How does a fledgling democracy settle accounts with the torturers from the old regime? This is the subject of the new book, A Miracle, A Universe, by Lawrence Weschler. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and wrote about Eastern Europe throughout the 80s. Weschler's new book examines two Latin American countries that recently made the transition from dictatorship to democracy. In Brazil, a small group of torture victims and human rights activists entered into a dangerous conspiracy to get even with the torturers in a nonviolent way. In Uruguay, there was a popular movement to overturn the amnesty that was granted to the military. Weschler says that it's very difficult for society to recover from the use of torture as a weapon of social and political control.
In the same way that a torture victim doesn't recover simply from being released from prison, that in fact torture has a tremendous impact on the rest of his life and can have destroyed it, torture societies don't recover simply by holding elections. I mean, this is the great kind of thing in the press right now is that all these countries are becoming democracies, whether in Eastern Europe or in Latin America. But in fact, they have tremendous problems left over from the torture experience, and particularly from the experience of secrecy, of denial, of the military refusing to open the books and to allow even trials or let alone truth tellings about what actually took place.
Let's look at the example of Brazil. Now, amnesty was given to the torturers in Brazil.
Right.
But there was a movement of torture victims and human rights activists to make public who the torturers were by publishing a book. And the book was based on military records. Can you describe the records that were the foundation of this book?
People can't get over this. The Brazilian military, who took over, by the way, in a coup in 1964, aided and abetted by the United States, the Brazilian military were technocrats. They kept records. They did everything by the book. And in effect, they ended up keeping minutes of the torture sessions themselves. Not exactly. What happened is that they would have these kind of kangaroo courts. The main evidence against the person would be the confession elicited under torture. When the confession was read into the record, the person would say, but I was tortured, and would describe how he was tortured. And the stenographer would sit there and type it all up. So that at the by 1979, when the military declared an amnesty for itself, it was in fact the case that there was a whole archive of these court records in the basement of the Supreme Military Court building in Brasilia. And it wasn't so much a movement in Brazil. It was just a very small group of people who were protected under the umbrella of Cardinal Arns of Sao Paulo, who's an extraordinary liberation theologian cardinal in South America. Anyway, these people got the idea on an overnight basis, surreptitiously, to kind of check out these documents as if they were just doing research of a completely different sort, check them out overnight, Xerox them, return them the next morning. It was completely against the idea of what should be done with these documents. It was very dangerous for them to be doing this. They were sure they would get caught, but they would Xerox them. They would spirit the Xeroxes down to Sao Paulo. They would microfilm them in Sao Paulo and then to get the microfilms out of the country. They thought they would get caught at some point, but at least there would be some evidence of what had actually gone on. They wouldn't be able to deny that this had happened. And instead, what happened is that they weren't caught. They went on for 3 years doing this. One day they realized that they had over 1 million pages of Xeroxed pages. and they had the entire universe of documents in the archive. That's one of the reasons I call the book A Miracle, A Universe. One of the universes involved is the entire universe of torture had been reproduced by these people. They then set about compiling, computerizing it, doing all sorts of analyses. They eventually had a 27-volume history. They had the 444 torturers named. They had where the tortures had taken place, the kinds of torture, the names of the victims, and so forth. They condensed that to a single volume. They published that volume with absolutely no fanfare whatsoever on June 15th, 1985. On June 30th, 1985, it reached number one on the Brazilian bestseller lists. It remained number one for the next year. It is now the single best-selling book in the history of Brazil, a book of nonfiction.
It's really remarkable that these records continue to exist after the military dictatorship stopped existing. Aren't these records usually destroyed?
They probably would have been destroyed in the process of the transition. The transition kind of went from 1979, when that amnesty was announced as a kind of early phase of it. It culminated in 1985 with a semi-free election. No doubt during that period, at some point, they would have tried to destroy them. I asked one of the people, you know, how could you have gotten away with this? And, you know, they said efficiency, luck, and divine protection. Another person, I said, how could you have gotten away with this? And he said, it was because after all those years of dictatorship, they couldn't even imagine that somebody would be doing this. And I think that's really true. It didn't even occur to them that somebody would do this. By the way, very early on in their compiling of records, they're Xeroxing, they realized that one of the main torturers back in his days, 10 years earlier as a young corporal or something, had risen in the meantime to become the head of the Brazilian FBI, in effect the man whose job it was to prevent this from happening.
Hmm.
And he would have had a personal reason to do so if he had even heard about it. And yet for 5 years they were able to keep it a secret.
When information was disclosed about who the torturers were, were there any surprises there? I mean, were they mostly people who were in the military who you'd expect to have that role or expect to have that role? But you know what I mean. were there any people who were really surprising who showed up on those lists?
There were some surprises in the sense that the Brazilian military is so bound up in kind of the industrial complex. I mean, they were very, very much in charge of running the technologizing of the economy. So it turned out that these people in fairly high positions in at this point, I mean, I don't have particulars at this moment, but, you know, automobile factories or ambassadors to various countries and so forth turned out to have been on that list. And so there were quite a few scandals. There was a guy who was now the transportation director of Sao Paulo, the guy in charge of the bus system and so forth, was on that list.
Once the names of torturers were made public in this book in Brazil, what happened to them? I mean, there was an amnesty, so they weren't going to be imprisoned as a result of their names being made public. But I'm sure once the word was out, people would react to them very differently.
I think there was some of that. I mean, at one level, it was disappointing in the sense that, you know, nobody went to jail. There was this amnesty. On the other hand, I think to them personally, there was a kind of stigma attached to them, as well there ought to be. Some of them had their careers stymied to some extent. Some of them kind of became cause celebres of kind of renegade elements of the military. And even though in Brazil there was an amnesty, it was sustained, even in Uruguay the amnesty ended up being sustained, those generals who are now next time going to order torture to take place, those torturers whose whole life is based on the fantasy that nobody will ever know, no longer can sustain that fantasy. Because who knows what will happen in the future? These are two amazing examples of entirely different things happening.
Lawrence Weschler is my guest. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and we're talking about his new book, A Miracle, A Universe, Settling Accounts with Torturers. I think a point that you make in your book is that for some torture victims, truth is more important than retribution.
Yeah.
That the main thing is that people know what happened and who was responsible for it.
Over and over again, you see this. And that torture victims are not out for revenge. Conversely, over and over again you hear by kind of apologists for the military or people who believe that we have to put the past behind us, this is just revenge, that, you know, this is petty, you know, we've got more important things, we've got a democracy to secure. The fact of the matter is that countless times I interviewed torture victims who said, look, I don't want anybody to go to jail. If anyone, I know what jail is about. In Uruguay, which is a small country, repeatedly, again and again, torture victims encounter their torturers on the street. And I have one amazing interview with Luis Perez Aguirre, a priest in Uruguay who was leading the movement to overturn the amnesty in Uruguay. And yet when he encountered his torture victim on the street, he pulled him into a coffee shop, sat down with him, asked him how he was, told him that he forgave him personally. But having said that, he pointed out, it's up to me to forgive him. It's not up to the military to forgive itself, or up to the democracy with a gun to its head to forgive the military, or even a democratic vote, which eventually happened in Uruguay, with the military holding a gun to the electorate's head. It's not up to them to forgive.
I'll tell you, it's one thing to feel that you can offer somebody forgiveness. It's another thing to take them out to a cup of coffee and have a schmooze with them. I find that really hard to understand.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you frankly one thing about that, is that this may sound romantic, but the sorts of people that get tortured are better people than the sorts of people that do the torturing. These people, Perez Aguirre, the people in Brazil, Cardinal Arns, and so forth, are some of the most remarkable, large-hearted people, courageous, going back to the root of courage, which is in heart, cœur in French, and going back to Latin. And these people are of full hearts. And that is precisely why they were being tortured. It's that kind of person who was standing up to the regimes, to the dictatorship on behalf of other people and so forth. They had more kind of empathy for other people than perhaps some other people do. But in any case, over and over again, you see these people who finally also have not had the essential thing tortured out of them. Mm-hmm. They have not had fellow feeling tortured out of them, which is one of the functions of the torture in the first place.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about your research. And my guest is Lawrence Weschler. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and his new book is called A Miracle, A Universe, Settling Accounts with Torturers. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Lawrence Weschler is a staff writer for The New Yorker, where he's written about Eastern Europe and Latin America. His new book, A Miracle, A Universe, is about how Uruguay and Brazil dealt with torturers after the countries turned from military dictatorships to democracies. Let's look at the country of Uruguay. When that became a democracy, the president declared amnesty for torturers, but then there was a campaign to have a referendum that would overturn the amnesty. What was the argument for giving amnesty to the torturers?
It's a fairly strong argument, actually, and I have an interview with the president who makes it very clear. It took a little bit longer than that. What happened, to understand about Uruguay, by the way, Uruguay had been one of the foremost democracies in the world up until 1973. It was called the Sweden of Latin America. It had a laughable military and so forth. It then became the most repressed country on a per capita basis in terms of political incarceration in the world. It was a little city-state. It's just a city. It's Montevideo, population 1.5 million, and the countryside population 1.5 million. And so in a situation like that, the military was able to really set up a kind of Orwellian totalitarian system that had an incredible amount of torturers. On a per capita basis, comparing the United States, every single person in Seattle would have been tortured extensively. If it were the United States, in a country of 3,500,000 went into exile. So there was a horrible legacy. Anyway, as Uruguay emerged from this military dictatorship, the country was shaken. I think people were kind of stooped. They were in some way broken, and the military demanded an amnesty, got one. When I was interviewing President Sanguinetti, who was a very impressive man and who was one of the proponents of this amnesty, I quoted for him this line of Zbigniew Herbert, you know, that ignorance about those who have disappeared undermines the reality of the world. And this man's quite an intelligent man. He quoted me poem for poem. And he quoted a poem by Ernesto Renan to the effect that nations are built on great rememberings and great forgettings. And he pointed out that the French were still haggling over, you know, the St. Bartholomew Day massacre. They'd be killing each other to this day. But at a certain point, you have to let go of these things. You don't want to do it. It's not something you want to do. But in order to build the future, you need to do it. Another person who surprisingly was in favor of sustaining the amnesty in Uruguay was Jacobo Timmerman, the Argentinian. And he said to me that it was complicated, that it's not just a question of the political thing to do versus the ethical thing to do, that there's short-term ethics, which are the completely just ethics of, you know, recompense and redemption for the victim, but there's long-term ethics that doesn't happen again, that there be a democracy 10 years from now. I mean, I end up having strong feelings in one direction, but I don't in any way deny how complex the issues are.
You were saying before that it's often the case that torture victims are ready to forgive their torturers and move on. Does the case of Uruguay contradict that? Uruguay, where torture victims and human rights activists got together to organize a referendum that would overturn the amnesty.
Yeah. It was an incredibly arduous thing that they got together to do. They got together to get 25% of the country to sign a petition, which would allow the referendum, not only to sign, but to provide their ID numbers. It was a very arduous process in the face of a military that was saying, go ahead, sign that. You know, that's the list we'll use next time we come back into power. And then once they got that number, there was almost a filibuster to deny that they had done so. The electoral court threw out all kinds of signatures. It was a tremendously arduous process. Having said that, over and over again, I spoke with leaders of that campaign who said, what we want is trials. We want the truth to come out. We want the torturers cashiered out of the military, for example. We don't want them rising. We don't want, you know, former torturers to be the head of various, you know, we don't want doctors who took place in torture to be the head of military hospitals, which is in fact the case in Uruguay right now. We want a truth-telling, and after that, we're all for a pardon. But you can't pardon somebody, they would say, for something they don't admit to having done.
Well, the human rights groups lost the referendum, yeah, and the amnesty was not overturned. Was there still a level of victory here?
I think there was. First of all, in 1987, 86, when this process began, there was a real attempt to forget what had happened. And the whole campaign ventilated. There was a lot of truth-telling that took place during that campaign. Beyond that, I think that at the end of the day, the military was really chastened in Uruguay. They won that vote, but it was a close call. They could have lost it. I think they realized that. And parenthetically, the young people in Uruguay who had grown up under this Orwellian system of education, who you would have thought had been brainwashed by the military, in fact, voted overwhelmingly to overturn the amnesty.
Lawrence Weschler is my guest, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and author of the new book, A Miracle, A Universe, Settling Accounts with Torturers. Well, in Romania, one of the things under consideration now is how to deal with the Securitate, the former secret police. How is that issue being handled now? What are some of the referendums before the Romanian people?
Well, Romania remains an extremely complicated situation. Sometimes it's strange. I mean, I read stuff coming out of Haiti and I think of Romania, and vice versa. In Romania, you had a really fiendish situation where some estimates of upwards of a quarter of the population were in some way involved with the Securitate. That doesn't mean they were all torturers, but they were all informing on each other and so forth. Or in any case, there was the impression that that was going on. And there was certainly a great deal of torture. By the way, it's worth noting that this is another one of these countries that, for geopolitical reasons, the United States basically turned a blind eye on that torture. Ceausescu was the great independent ally of Israel, blah, 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 and we weren't going to look too deeply into what was going on. That country desperately needs some forum for truth-telling, for establishing what took place, and at the same time, by the way, for protecting the rights, the legitimate rights, legal rights of people who are accused. That's, by the way, one of the reasons you need to have these things as trials, as judicial processes, and not just publications of books, because, you know, people can get accused and they don't have any due process. And in the short term, Romania has tried to limit discussion of these issues to the immediate events surrounding the December revolution and to try and more or less say, we don't have time. Look, we've got so many things we have to do. We don't have time to look much more deeply. There's a good deal of suspicion that some of the people who are in the remaining government are still affiliated or with Securitate or had Securitate pasts. You get a lot of that same sort of thing in East Germany right now, where over and over again, leaders of these parties are turning out to have been, or at least to have been accused to have been informers for the security forces. So Romania, I feel pretty bleak about, partly because there's no framework of a judicial system at this point. There aren't lawyers or aren't human rights lawyers specializing in this. That country was civil society in that country was really asphyxiated for 40 years. And worse and worse as the years went by, and worse of all in the last 10 years. So they've got a lot of work to do.
Just a few years ago, the UN General Assembly had a convention on torture, and it drafted an international system for the prosecution of torturers. Mm-hmm. If that was signed and put into effect, what kind of model would it offer?
Well, it's not so much it wasn't that there would be international courts, but there certainly would be international monitoring. And to the extent that nations had signed the convention, which not that many have, there would be sanctions or there would be the right for sanctions against them. There would also be the opportunity for victims of disappearances, for instance, to go to regional courts. This is more inter-American human rights law and so forth. There are various things like that. Parenthetically, the United States has not signed those conventions.
Why not?
Well, we have all sorts of relationships with countries that are based on torture, to put it bluntly. I mean, El Salvador or Chile and so forth. I think rhetorically we'd say that's interference with internal life of these countries and so forth.
In your research, did you meet any of the torturers?
No, I did not.
Could you have? I mean, could you have, but you just decided not to?
It would have been a different sort of book. There are some people who are doing that, and it's something I may yet do, entirely different thing. And by the way, I mean, it would be a book about a mystery.
The mystery of why people do it.
Of how it can happen, yeah.
Okay.
By the way, I mean, having said that, one other thing to say is that have I met torturers? Yes, I mean, you meet them at news conferences in Washington, D.C., in a sense. I mean, we are funding, supported a lot of these regimes. And people in this country in three-piece suits voted obliviously to support this sort of behavior. So in a way, you can meet torturers on your TV screen every night.
Lawrence Weschler. His new book, A Miracle, A Universe, is published by Pantheon. Weschler is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Around the World in 80 Days, with former Monty Python star Michael Palin. He also played the stuttering thief in A Fish Called Wanda. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It was a big moment in the lives of the Castillo brothers when they played Desi's cousins on an episode of I Love Lucy. It's part of the story of the Mambo Kings play Songs of Love, the novel that won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction last week. Coming up, a talk with the author, Oscar Iuelos. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a pair of reissued albums by Ornette Coleman. Kevin says these reissues are the only available examples of Coleman's transitional work from the late 60s and early 70s. Spy Magazine has gained a reputation as the most biting satirical magazine around. Television critic David Bianculli tells us if Spy manages to keep its fangs as it makes the jump to TV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Cheers and applause for Black nationalist leader Nelson Mandela as he entered a concert hall in London tonight where an anti-apartheid concert was held. More than 70,000 rock fans jammed that arena for a concert that was televised to a potential audience of 1 billion people. Mandela later went backstage, and he told the rock stars taking part that they had given him tremendous inspiration during his 27 years in jail, and he said music reaches all parts of society.
Through your music, you reach people of different political affiliations. You reach workers, clerks, intellectuals, lawyers, doctors, and almost every section of our population.
And Mandela said that the message that is being sung now in certain regards can be stronger than the one sent out by politicians. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to consider whether business is protected from some pension lawsuits. The High Court said that it will use a Texas case to decide if workers may sue in state courts when they allege their employers fired them to avoid paying pension benefits. Business leaders, saying millions of dollars are involved, want the High Court to rule that such lawsuits are precluded by a federal law protecting pension benefits. A just-completed study of prostitutes in New York City finds that one-third may be infected with the AIDS virus. It's the largest study of prostitutes ever done in this country. NPR's Patricia Naiman reports.
For 9 months, Dr. Joyce Wallace cruised the streets of New York in her highly equipped van. She tried to teach prostitutes about the risk of contracting AIDS. She also convinced nearly 1,000 of them to get tested for evidence of the virus. The fact that nearly a third turned out to be already infected is not a big surprise. Health officials estimate that more than half of all IV drug users in New York City are infected. And earlier studies show that most prostitutes who work the streets, like the women in this study, are also IV drug users. There's even more evidence for a link between AIDS and IV drug use. So-called call girls, or women working for escort services who tend not to use IV drugs, have a far lower rate of AIDS infection. This is Patricia Naiman reporting.
A leaking gas cylinder exploded in a train in India today, touching off a fire that killed at least 80 people. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 11 points to close at 2,763.06 on volume of some 143 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Composer and alto saxophonist Ornette Coleman first shook up the jazz world in the late 1950s. Up until then, jazz improvising had always been based on fixed chord sequences, but Coleman dispensed with that. Since then, he's experimented with various group sounds, an eight-piece double quartet on his 1960 Free Jazz album, and a spare trio in the mid-60s. Now Coleman leads an electric band called Prime Time with two guitars, two basses, and two drummers. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of two Coleman reissues from 1968 at the juncture between his early freewheeling music and his dense modern music.
Ornette Coleman is one of the most important figures in the history of jazz. but he hasn't made all that many records in the last 30-odd years, and their reissue-crazy major labels have been slow to put his old albums out on compact disc. In fact, all of the records he made in the late 60s and early 70s have been out of print for a while. But now Blue Note has reissued a pair of Coleman albums recorded in 1968. They're called New York Is Now and Love Call. In each case, an alternate take of one or two tunes has been added to the program, and one performance on Love Call is being issued in the U.S. for the first time. It's called Just For You, and has Coleman playing raw trumpet instead of his usual alto sax. New York Is Now and Love Call are Ornette's only records with John Coltrane's old bass and drum team of Jimmy Garrison and Elvin Jones. As they did with Coltrane, Garrison and Jones often pull in different directions. They help Coleman move toward the polyrhythmic music he plays now. Ornette's own sound on alto sax is his usual bluesy cry, one of the most compelling voice-like and classic styles in jazz. When Coleman first hit the scene, detractors called him an anarchist. But his improvised variations are easy to follow as one phrase inspires the next. Here's some of Coleman's Airborne from the album Love Call. Rounding out this 1968 quartet is tenor saxophonist Dewey Redman, who'd be Coleman's alter ego for the next 5 years. These are his first studio sessions with Coleman. Redman had managed the feat of transferring Ornette's distinctive alto style to the tenor sax. Some of his lines sound strikingly like the Leader's, but he doesn't sacrifice his own identity. One way Dewey Redman asserted his own style is through the use of multiphonics, thick sounds a horn player gets by singing one note while playing another. Redman began singing to his horn in the early 1960s. He once told me the sound just popped out of his throat while he was playing one night. It surprised him so much he couldn't get to sleep later. Coleman's occasional dabbling on trumpet or scratchy violin serves the same purpose as Dewey Redman's multiphonics. They add a different color and rougher texture to the music. Coleman's trumpeting ranges from the inspired to the inept. Now that these records are out, maybe the Impulse and Columbia labels will be inspired to reissue their late 60s and early 70s Coleman records. Like these Blue Notes, they help chart the evolution of a master who's always true to himself, but never stops changing.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed two Ornette Coleman reissues on the Blue Note label, New York Is Now and Love Call.
We now interrupt for our commercial.
This is Fresh Air. Last week, the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction went to Oscar Iuelos for his novel The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. The novel is set in New York and remembers the mambo craze of the 50s and what the music meant to Cuban Americans. The story is about two Cuban brothers in a mambo band who appear on an episode of the I Love Lucy show as Desi's singing cousins. Novelist Oscar Iuelos is a Cuban-American who grew up in New York in the 50s. I spoke with Iuelos last summer when his book was published. Iuelos told me he gave Desi Arnaz a central role in his novel because Desi was something of a hero in the Iuelos home.
My father, who was definitely very Cuban, coming from Oriente province, which was where Arnaz was born, used to love that show. And I didn't think that it was a plastic image, which a lot of people say it is, the image of Arnaz. I think he did a good job. He was slick. He was also very human at the same time. He was funny. He was a very decent musician. And I think he came off as a very humane entertainer. And it's amazing to me that for 5 years, I Love Lucy was the number one show in the United States. And I think it perhaps had some kind of influence on the way indirectly, that people have regarded Cubans anyway.
Did you ever meet Desi Arnaz?
No, only in my dreams.
And was he in your dreams? Did you fantasize your family being guests on the show?
No, but I had an uncle who used to play with Xavier Cugat back in the 1930s. He played touring around in Europe and in Miami. The man has been gone for 25 years, but as a kid, he had this house in Miami, and in his garage where he had lots of photographs, there was a photograph of him with Xavier Cugat and also one with Desi Arnaz. So though I'd never met him, I sort of feel this spiritual link.
The two main characters in your novel play in a band called the Mambo Kings. Has that always seemed like the ultimate experience to you, to play in a good, stylish band?
Yeah, definitely. when I was younger, I used to play in bands here and there up in the Bronx, but you know, rock and roll, but all kinds of music. I would think that playing in a big time acoustic band from the 30s, 40s, or even the 50s would be an incredible, liberating, and beautiful experience.
When you were younger, were you ever taken to ballrooms that had the kinds of bands playing that you describe in the book, and the kind of dance contests and other contests that were held?
Well, when I was writing the book, I interviewed a lot of the musicians and ballroom hoppers from that era. Mostly when I was a kid, I just went to social clubs and the parties and things. And part of the reason why I wrote the book is, first of all, I love the music, and I love the people who sort of are connected with it. So I know people who are rather old who still act like they're rather young, and they still dress elegantly, and they have that lifestyle, which is they go out dancing. I mean, my mother's 78 years old, and I believe she went dancing last year. So it sort of has to do with, I guess, the vibrancy of that epoch. things have changed. Things have become more superficial, I must say. Everybody's hip. Nobody pays dues. In those days, I think people were more sincere in their lifestyles.
I was wondering if writing this book was, in a way to create a scene that you were too young to experience yourself.
In a word, yes, I think. But it's also meant as a tribute, and I don't think if you don't write something down, it disappears. The center of the book, which has to do with Desi Arnaz, has much more to do with nostalgia and memory and the way one remembers people who they've loved. I like the idea of using the rerun as a take on memory, but maybe I'm building it up further than to something more than what it is. But I wanted also to do an informal sort of history of the scene.
You mentioned using the rerun as memory. And the rerun is the I Love Lucy program, in which the two brothers, the two members of the Mambo Kings, make a guest appearance. There's a paragraph that relates to that I'd very much like you to read. It's on the opening page.
Uh-huh. Okay. Some months later, I don't know how many, I wasn't 5 years old yet, they began to rehearse for the immortal appearance of my father on this show. For me, my father's gentle rapping on Ricky Ricardo's door has always been a call from the beyond, as in Dracula films or films of The Walking Dead, in which spirits ooze out from behind tombstones and through the cracked windows and rotted floors of gloomy antique halls. Lucille Ball, the lovely red-headed actress and comedian who played Ricky's wife, was house-cleaning when she heard the rapping of my father's knuckles against the door. "I'm coming," in her sing-song voice. Standing in her entrance, two men in white silk suits and butterfly-looking lace bow ties, black instrument cases by their side, and black-brimmed white hats in their hands. My father, Nestor Castillo, thin and broad-shouldered, and Uncle Cesar, thick-set and immense. My uncle, "Mrs. Ricardo, my name is Alfonso, and this is my brother Manny." And her face lights up, and she says, "Oh, yes, the fellows from Cuba. Ricky told me all about you." Then just like that, they're sitting on the couch when Ricky Ricardo walks in and says something like, "Manny, Alfonso, gee, it's really swell that you fellas could make it up here from Havana for the show." That's when my father smiled. The first time I saw a rerun of this, I could remember other things about him.
The two brothers in the Mambo Kings, mm-hmm. the two who make the appearance on I Love Lucy, they both came to the States from Cuba before Castro. They came, what, in the 1940s in your novel?
Yeah, 1949, January.
And they have their band, and they have this guest appearance on the Lucy show, but everything fizzles, and things mm-hmm. things don't turn out like the success that they might have. Was that something that you experienced in your family? Your parents also came to New York from Cuba, I believe, in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm. Well, by fizzled, what do you mean? I don't see the musician brothers as being failures. I just think that they had their moments. I mean, I think the one of the points of the book is that love is very important. And in terms of my own family, my father and mother did come here in the 40s, and they were not rich people. But on the other hand, they produced a novelist and a painter, and under difficult circumstances. So I don't consider that a fizzling out experience.
Mm-hmm.
And see, that's the whole thing. The book is basically about decent people who are artistic, who don't make it big, but in a way make it big. They make it big in other people's hearts. They make it big in other people's memories. They make it big musically. This is... you know, everybody dies sooner or later, and that's a fizzling out, if you want to call it.
The main character in your first novel, when he's 25 and is thinking about his father, says, "Our lives were much different. I'm almost 25. At that age, I've been told my father was running some kind of mail route by burrow in mm-hmm. southeastern Cuba. Mm-hmm. Me, I work on East 47th Street in a tall building with a sloping glass front."
Uh-huh.
How autobiographical is that?
I have that feeling, I must say. Yeah, I think I've often asked myself what would my life have been like had I been born 50 years earlier. And I think I would have probably had my father's life, which was to have been born in a farm and then make decisions from there, which is to come to the States or stay there. The thing about Cubans who, of my father's generation, the ironic thing is that if he had stayed in Cuba, he would have left because of the revolution, no doubt. And he was destined to come here, for example.
What brought your parents to the States?
I just think they were fairly ambitious in a way, high-stepping. My father, I think, was an ambitious chap, and I guess he wanted to see something different. And Cubans I've talked to who came here in that period were often talk about just being enamored of the image of the States that they saw from movies, but also it wasn't an impossibility. I mean, people sometimes just went from Cuba to the United States, spent 3 months, went back for years and years and years.
In both of your novels, there's a character who is devastated by the death of someone close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first novel,
very good.
In the first novel, the mother says after her husband has died, and the son is thinking about the father too. And the mother says, if you think too much about a dead person, he will think you are calling him.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something your mother ever told you, and would you explain what that means?
Oh, I heard it on some street corner one day. what I think is that, you know, people linger on in memory, and my experience with Cubans is that there's a very strong sense that the dead are not dead, and that it's not impossible to, I wouldn't say summon them, but they're always with you.
Well, thanks a lot for doing the interview.
Okay, well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oscar Iuelos was just awarded a Pulitzer Prize for his novel The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux.
Babalo, ba-
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, a trial begins today in New York for those charged in the death of a young black man in the Bensonhurst section of Brooklyn. His death was both the cause and presumably the symptom of considerable racial tension in the city of New York. We'll be following that. We'll also be looking to Lithuania, where the parliament is meeting today, one day after the ultimatum delivered by Soviet President Gorbachev runs out. And we are also seeing what we can do about pursuing the winners of the Boston Marathon.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. People magazine tried it, so did Esquire. This Wednesday night, Spy magazine shifts to the TV screen with a special called Spy Magazine Presents How to Be Famous. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
According to this Spy magazine comedy special, being famous is tricky. But so is taking an irreverent and intelligent magazine and transferring it to television. Spy the magazine is famous for poking fun at people on the inside while remaining defiantly on the outside. It attacks Donald Trump by calling him, on almost every reference, a short-fingered vulgarian. It identifies a prominent New York Times columnist as Abe, I'm writing as bad as I can, Rosenthal. Spy is fascinating to read because it tells so much about what goes on in Hollywood, at the New York Times, at the broadcast networks, and on the general celebrity circuit. And usually, when the magazine makes fun of someone, it's well-deserved. But how does Spy, which regularly ridicules the business of television, turn itself into a TV special without joining the club? How does it put human voices to its printed insults without sounding even more mean-spirited and alienating people? And how does it appeal to middle America without losing its big city edge? The answer to all of the above is, it doesn't. Some segments are interesting, like the one which uses a hidden camera to see how a room full of tourists react to the unexpected appearance of an actual celebrity. Victoria Jackson of Saturday Night Live describes this scientific experiment.
Look, there's Ricardo Montalban entering and going to his box. See how the normal people instantly recognize him as a celebrity. Spontaneously, they form a tight semicircle. Note, however, that they refrain from making physical contact while Mr. Montalban regales them with a light anecdote about the making of Fantasy Island. In order to test the celebrity's command of the environment, we now introduce a control element. Three coffee and donuts on the opposite side of the room. Yum!
The result?
Final analysis, famous people definitely hold an unusual fascination for normal people. But then, so do glazed donuts.
I also like the segment in which Joan Namath gives a play-by-play analysis of the way Eddie Murphy's entourage guides Eddie through a crowd.
This is my favorite part. Now watch this very carefully, Jerry. You see, now here's a slightly less popular comedian, Chevy Chase, right here. See how Chevy reaches out to touch Eddie?
Yeah.
He wants Eddie to stop and talk. Eddie doesn't want to seem like a jerk, so he has one of his own handlers move him along and slide in to cut Chevy off before he becomes a real nuisance.
That's something.
Can we look at that one more time?
But that's a lot like a possible segment from Not Necessarily the News, just like the Montalban experiment owes a lot to Candid Camera. The overall tone of How to Be Famous, in fact, is a lot like that of Late Night with David Letterman. Finally, this spy special also recycles a lot of its own printed material. From features on celebrities' tans and eyeglasses to some of its more famous separated-at-birth photo comparisons. Some things survive the transition to television, most don't. Even though the show tries to look hip and act hip, it doesn't come off that way. Based on this first special, I'll stick to the magazine.
David Bianculli is TV critic for The New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Ajiva Blytus, Thad Kirk, and Dan Lachlan. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Michael Palin was one of the founding members of Monty Python's Flying Circus. On the next Fresh Air, Palin tells us about his recent journey in the footsteps of Phineas Fogg, around the world in 80 days. And we meet one of the fastest pitchers in baseball history, Bob Feller. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Enjoy a wide range of music, from folk to classical to jazz, with more than a few surprises in between. You can hear it every Monday through Thursday night at 11 and weekday mornings between 5 and 6. That's Sound Passages right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.